Welcome to Wild Hearts at Work, a podcast redefining our relationship with work through stories and conversations with wild hearts who have dared to challenge the status quo. And now, here's your host, Melissa Boggs.
Hello to all our listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Subject Matter Pros. We would like to take a quick moment to thank our sponsors, OCSDeals.ca and Branding and Promo, for their help and support in helping us make this podcast happen. OCSDeals.ca is a cannabis directory helping consumers search better and shop smarter. Check them out at OCSDeals.ca. Their name is a URL. And Branding and Promo is a digital marketing agency who help us with our website, social media, and everything else digital. You can visit them at brandingandpromo.com to learn more. So writer Annie Dillard famously said, "How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives." Now, for many of us, a large portion of our day is spent at work. It's estimated that most adults spend about a third of their day at work. So over a period of time, the average person will have spent about 90,000 hours at work over their lifetime. Therefore, it is very safe to say that your job can and has a huge impact on your life and everything surrounding it. Too often, we see organizations that are stuck in the past, and their employee retention rates reflect that. With the high degree of employee turnover that is being observed in the marketplace now, it is more important than ever to create an organization that honors the talents and passions of your employees. It addresses the needs of multi-generational workforces and builds confidence and success for upcoming leaders in the organization. All these factors can have a positive impact on the working lives of your team and colleagues. And for your company, this prevents you from losing your greatest assets, which are your talented people, to your competitors. The technological revolution of the 21st century changed the way we work. The COVID-19 pandemic changed how we work. The pandemic has opened the door and accelerated the movement for change in the workplace. The Great Resignation is just the beginning of employees demanding a different relationship and experience with their jobs. A clear message is being sent by all employees all over the world that the time for change is now. So what does the future of work look like? To discuss that, please welcome our guest today, Melissa Boggs. Melissa.
Hello.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you for being on our show. So Melissa is a keynote speaker, leadership coach, and an employee experience designer. She's also a former co-CEO with a background in leadership, business, and product development. She also has a podcast that she hosts. It's called Wild Hearts at Work, where Melissa and her guests are redefining our relationship with work through stories and conversations with those individuals that are challenging the status quo of today's workplace. So, you know, she's a perfect guest to have on this episode today. So, Melissa, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you coming on Subject Matter Pros.
My pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
So let's jump right into it. What will the workplace of the future look like, Melissa?
So I envision a workplace actually quite similar to the one that I had the privilege of growing up in. I'm using air quotes. And so let me describe that. That's what I see the future of work being. I had the privilege of working at a place from age 20 to 32, where I had clarity of mission. I felt that I contributed to the mission. And I felt that I was able to bring my creativity, my talent, and my own entrepreneurship to the workplace. And it's rare that you have these workplaces where the organization is not threatened by your innovation, your invention, and is willing to make space for that. So I think what we're looking at now post-pandemic is a workplace that embraces all of those things and takes responsibility for what it takes to actually make that possible.
Those are some really great key areas. You know, you're very lucky that early on in your career, you had the privilege to experience this wholesome, where it allows you to thrive and flourish and actually want to be a part of the team. So while there is no one-size-fits-all approach, how do you create a culture of excellence that maximizes the potential of one's organization?
So I actually have a model that I've somewhat recently created, and it's pretty easy to remember because it's 5 C's. If you were to look at it visually, it's a pyramid. It's sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but I jokingly call it Melissa's hierarchy of work needs. And it has nothing to do with, you know, the snacks in the refrigerator or, you know, ping pong in the break room, although those things are nice. At the base of this pyramid is clarity. And that is a lot easier said than done. So let's just acknowledge that for a moment. But clarity of the mission, clarity of role, clarity of the work, focus, all of these things are sort of involved in creating clarity for an organization. Next up, with clarity being the foundation, is context. This is where you see more and more leaders being expected and pushed to share the why behind their decisions and to create context so that folks closer to the work and closer to the customers can make better decisions. So often I think that, you know, leaders might get frustrated with teams because they didn't make the decisions that they would make as a leader when they're not recognizing how much more information they might have than that team, and vice versa. There's often that the teams have context that the leader doesn't have because they're too far away from the work. Next is craft. This comes back to, you know, honoring people's talent, honoring their creativity, and just recognizing people want to be excellent. I know very few people who wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm just going to go phone it in today. So creating, you know, working groups, creating space for them to be more excellent at their craft, understanding if they're working on the right things that will let their biggest talent contribute to the mission. Next up in the pyramid is choice. And I should mention, the higher up the pyramid you get, the harder it gets. And like the less accessible it is for some leaders, because some of them are not willing to do some of this. There's sacrifices that have to be made, but choice, you know, allowing people to have choice around what they work on, as long as it's in service to the mission, allowing them to have choice about who they work with, any place where you can actually give, you know, fully grown up autonomous human beings the ability to make a choice, they're going to be more engaged and they're going to be more excellent. And then taking choice one step further at the very tip of the pyramid as probably the hardest thing to do, but the most impactful, is co-creation. As it's really just taking choice one step further. But instead of saying you have a choice between A or B, saying, hey, team, here's the mission. How can we co-create not only the way there, but how you are going to contribute to that? Those are the things I think that will set organizations apart in the next, I'd say, 5 to 10 years.
Those are some very powerful set of rules. I like how well you articulated them, especially in their degree of difficulty in implementing them in the workplace. And I really like, you know, how you mentioned that there's an inherent need for people wanting to be excellent, and that nobody really says, hey, I don't want to give it my all. But one too often, you do see people, you know, who drag themselves through their day. They've lost some of their motivation. And then you also mentioned how, as you start getting to the peak of the pyramid, it gets harder because now you're starting to really get leadership to buy into something, some of these changes, right? Because you have the context, for example, flows both ways, where you have from leadership down to the team and then team up to the leaders to make sure everyone's interests and things are aligned. Co-creation, again, is a much higher level extension of that context where you're all working together in harmony for a common goal or objective. So at what level do you start building such a culture, and how do you start it? Like, do you start it with the leadership? Do you start it with the front line, with the new hires? How does one go about bringing some of these practices into play?
So I do acknowledge that while I believe everyone gets out of bed in the morning and, you know, wants to do well, they're all doing so within the context of their system and their environment. So I actually, she'd kill me if she knew I was saying this, but I have to think this way about my teenage daughter and my preteen son sometimes. Like, my daughter does not get out of bed in the morning and want to irritate the ever-living daylights out of me. Not to say that she does, but she is a product of her system. So in my home, what is the environment that I am creating to allow her to be her best self at home? And the same goes for work. Now, I'm not a believer in like leaders being paternal or, you know, parental. So that's not what I'm saying by making that comparison. But leaders have privilege. There is a certain amount of privilege that comes with having, quote unquote, climbed the ranks. That privilege includes title. That privilege includes, you know, financial privilege. But it also includes information and context that I was talking about before. And so while I am a huge proponent of the idea that that trust has to be bidirectional, it must start with the leader. And it must start with the leader at the highest level of the company. Because if that person is not creating the environment and understanding the system in which people are operating, they're the only ones that can actually begin that change. Now, once they've begun, other people can jump in and help create that culture and create that change. But any change that you make inside the organization is going to be subject to that top leader or those top leaders' cultural gravity, right? So if I make huge changes in my team, but the reward systems, the structure of the company are not conducive to those changes, then those changes could go sideways very, very quickly. And so while it is bidirectional, the privilege of leadership implies that people have to, at that level, make the first move, basically. You know, make the first phone call, make the first step in saying, I want to create more trust here. You know, I want to co-create. I'm willing to give up X, Y, Z, because I think, you know, it's better for all of us if we co-create this.
That's fair. You know, like, it must start with the leaders. But like, when you have an organization that is established, that has a team in place, humans are also creatures of habits. So once you get set in a certain set of ways, the leadership may want to make the change, but it may not always be possible to get some of the rest of the team members to wholeheartedly buy into that. So in a situation like that, do you start bringing in those changes with new hires? Do you recommend, this is a very harsh recommendation, but do you recommend sort of cleaning house with team members that are not on board with the leaders that are committed to making these kinds of changes so that the organization can flourish? Or how do you approach the second degree of challenge where once leadership is all bought into it and the CEO and your C-suite and all the other high-level silo leaders are all on board, how do you get the rest of the team to buy into this?
It's a combination of things. One, your team is going to be watching. So if you're one of those leaders, your team is not going to accept the change until they begin to trust that that change is A, real, and B, more or less permanent or stable, at least. So there's going to be a time period where you should always be living your values and, you know, walking the talk, but there's going to be a specific time period where, okay, you just said this was important. Now I'm going to watch you. I'm going to watch you and see if your actions demonstrate to me that this is important. You're going to have to earn that trust. The second piece is actually John Cotter wrote a book quite a while ago now called Leading Change. And he has like an 8-step process for leading this type of change. And I think one of the most powerful things, he talks about, you know, creating this vision that everyone can see themselves in. And I think one of the most impactful ways to do that is by being really focused on your customer and how you're changing your customers' lives, right? People want to feel important. They want to feel like they're making a difference. And so if you can you can paint that picture. And then the second thing is he talks about a guiding coalition. All 8 steps are really important, by the way, but those 2 are the ones that I see being essential to this kind of change. And that guiding coalition can be formal or informal, but it is a group of people who for lack of a better term, get it, are into it, are bought into it, are enthusiastic, and can help make that change sticky from the inside out. They will understand better than the leader the impact of the change on the people on the ground and the value of the change to the people on the ground. So they'll be able to say, like, let me think of an example. We're changing performance reviews, or maybe getting rid of them altogether, right? Hey, friends on my team. Yeah, I understand, you know, I understand what we're giving up. I understand what we're sacrificing with this change. But here's what we're getting out of it. Like, here's what might be really cool on the other side of this. You have to have a handful of people throughout the organization, kind of at every level, that can see that. I can see both sides of it, basically, what's hard about it and what's good about it. And that's what will help to make it sticky, is people who get it talking to other people who are having a harder time getting it. And then to your point, I mean, if we're talking about like massive transformation of culture, inevitably you have people who signed on for one thing. And if you're changing it, then it's no longer the job that they signed on for. And that's fair. You know, maybe they want more structure, or they want to be told what to do, or, you know, they don't want co-creation. And that's fair. You know, and those people, we just have to treat them with the most dignity and respect, and, you know, even help them beyond our company to find the right place for them.
Very well said. You know, maintaining that as a leader, you really have to demonstrate to your team that you handle the entire process with utmost sincerity and class, so that everyone else buys into that. What are some changes that, you know, you see are going to be implemented in the short run? You know, like anything relating to salary and how things are, you know, like classically salary discussions have been very opaque. You know, vacation time and vacation policies have also been very stringent. Like, what kind of changes do you expect? Like, I mean, the five C's that you mentioned, they're more value-based about how an organization has to evolve and adapt. And that would be different for the type of business one is in, the size of the organization, how they operate. But being, taking it a step back, being a little bit more general, what kind of changes are you seeing, you know, or do you expect companies will really have to implement right away to make sure that at least while some of those other more longer term processes come into play, in the short run, they've set together the infrastructure that would allow them to retain quality talent and also hire on new quality talent?
So actually, I think those things are super tied together. So I'll give you mentioned the PTO example. What I'm starting to see more and more, you know, we went through the phase of unlimited PTO, and people started to point out the issues with it, which is that unlimited PTO means you actually don't know what the thresholds are. It sounds great on the surface, but you become afraid, like, have I taken too much? You know, like, we don't know what the boundaries are. And so what I'm starting to see is organizations having a minimum PTO policy. And to me, that actually has to do with co-creation, right? Like, you have to take at least this much amount of time off, because we recognize that taking a break is important, that our best ideas come from having a relaxed brain. And we want to co-create the experience of work and life with you. I am actually a big proponent of actually not talking about work-life balance, because it's all life. So what is strategic self-care in your life? And can we co-create what your life looks like, recognizing that this org is just a part of your bigger life? So we want you to take time off. So that one I am super excited to see. And it's very North American, because, you know, in Europe, they have a much healthier relationship with taking time off. You'll see, like, taking the entire summer off. And interestingly, their companies do not collapse. You know? So that's one that I see that's like becoming more and more common. You mentioned salary. I think this also has to do with choice. So it's becoming more common. I think it started in Colorado, but before the podcast, you mentioned that New York is now requiring employers to put the salary range in their job descriptions. I am actually a huge believer in salary transparency. I believe that the more that we can talk about salary, the more choice that we have. And right now, it only benefits organizations, like the company itself, to not talk about salary, because whether it's intentional or not, that actually gives them, you know, more leeway or the ability to hide salary inequities. And so when salary ranges are in job descriptions, when employees are actively talking about their salary in organizations where the company is like, oh, that's fine. We feel comfortable with that. We're okay with it. If you come to us and say there's an inequity, we're willing to deal with it. I mean, that's, if you want to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, having that kind of attitude, recognizing we're not perfect, wanting to know where we have opportunities to make things better, and employees making a choice, not, well, you've sold me on this company. It's really cool. I think this is a good enough salary, but I really don't know how I compare to other people, you know, in the company or other people outside the company. You know, you're actually removing, I don't want to overuse this word, but a little bit of consent when they don't have all the information. So I think that's going to become really important too. And so those five C's, I actually do think that they play into the micro and the macro of what these workplaces need to look like in the next few years. Because again, I'm going to be dramatic, but it's just funny for a minute. The people are rising up. And if you want that great talent, they're smart people. That great talent are people who are going to be super aware of what value they bring and need you to show them what value you can bring to them.
That's true. And, you know, in a world where increasingly a lot of growth is coming through technology and other forms where you don't necessarily have, now you have the luxury where if you're not in the city where the company's headquarters are, you can still be a contributing member to the team. If you bring assets that are, that work well within the organization, you have a skill set that is well reflected. And there's been so much turnover over the last few years, not just the pandemic, even pre-pandemic, where it was commonplace for people to jump from one organization to another and so on and so forth. Because again, the transfer costs for the employees are so low because it's not like you have institutional apprentice work that you're leaving behind or something where you want to be with a master, right? You're going into this organization where you're going to be doing the same task at organization A, B, or C. Let's just see which one in this present moment offers the best set of sort of lifestyle and principles and everything else surrounding how the employee wants to be treated. So it's super important where companies really start understanding the power of it's not completely a power shift because employers still pay wages. So people still need to work together, but definitely there has been a rising of the people where they understand the flexibility they have and the fact that they have the choice to seek out employers who are willing to offer some of these benefits and make concessions such as, hey, you know what? You don't have to be in the same city where I'm located. As long as you're willing to be available when we're all available together so that we can grow and develop together. That is important.
One thing I want to add just really quick is when we start to talk about taking care of employees, I definitely start to see leaders like squirm a little bit because for two reasons. One, folks that are in powerful positions right now were raised both, you know, in their family life, but also in their professional life by the generation before them. So what you have right now is the millennials, the ones that were supposedly like so spoiled, are now either the middle managers or they're becoming like the VPs. I think we have forgotten that millennials didn't stay 20 years old, right? So we are now, I'm like right on the edge of that. We are now kind of the older generation in the workplace, or at least the middle. And we were raised by the generation before us. So there's this sort of internal battle that's happening, probably even just within us. Like, here's what I was taught, but here's what I see in the world. Because this generation has more information than any generation before us, right? With the fact that for me, the internet came out when I was in junior high. So I have grown up with the world at my fingertips, and I can't unsee the things that I have seen. So there's a little squirming that happens about that, because it's like, who's more important, the org or the people? When actually, like, the org is the people. But the other thing is, I am not ever going into an organization saying, let's create an employee experience just for the sake of being a cool place, right? So when you look at the 5 C's and the things that I teach leaders, all of them are in service to the mission. They're not just to, like, let's attract talent and then just have them sit around and stare at each other. So that clarity that's at the very bottom, that's about the mission. That's about being a successful business for everyone's sake. And so I don't ever want leaders to hear, you know, some of the things that we're talking about with like minimum PTO or salary transparency and think like, well, we're only doing this to attract people. The analogy I love using is I used to run, and I was a, like I would run 10Ks, and you'd have the people along the route who were offering water and orange slices and the little power squeezy things. People didn't come to the race for oranges and water and squeezy things, right? I didn't come so I could just like, ooh, give me some oranges. I can go buy oranges at the store. I came for the race, and that's what I needed in order to make it to the end, right? I needed orange slices and water and squeezy things. I'm sure there's a technical term for those. And so I just want to encourage leaders to not immediately shut down and think like, oh, this generation behind us is so spoiled. No, actually, we're just starting to recognize what people need in order to do the things that you want them to do, in order to be innovative and keep up with the pace of change in the world that we live in now, where all of us have information at our fingertips.
And that is the biggest, I think, hurdle or mind block that exists between the generations is the access and availability of information. I mean, when I was growing up too, like I had access to world books and other written forms of information content, but you know, those were
updated. 10 years old.
Exactly. They're updated ever so periodically. Things are not always current. And there was a very high degree of secrecy and transparency that people really like to retain. And then where a lot of our growth as a civilization has come is it's been from that open source mindset where, hey, let's just collaborate together and share ideas, because end of the day, there's so many smart people, and why not work together and stand on the shoulder of giants rather than trying to create the same thing again and again by yourself, where now you're creating a deadweight loss for society as a whole. Like, yes, okay, you know, there could be that this is my stuff, but why not share that with people? And you're seeing that, like even companies such as Tesla are releasing a lot of their modules and technologies where, like, this is, you know, they have such large competitors who could potentially vulture them at any time given their stronghold in the market. Yet this company has the progressive mindset to share some of its technologies because it understands the long run benefit to humanity by opening up some of these things. And that's something about tech that I really enjoy is their open source mindset, where it's like, hey, let's just share stuff. And then if you can understand how this is written and you want to customize it to your own personal needs and grow from it, because now you have a launch pad, a runway that's already built for you rather than spending time laying down the groundwork, everybody wins.
An abundance mindset. And it's also this notion that, like, not every man for himself, right? Like community, we are actually like wired to be communities. If you read, like, I think the biggest game changer for me was reading the book Sapiens, where they talk about like the importance of community. And, you know, psychology will tell you like we need each other. And so why wouldn't we actually use that to our like communal advantage and be better? Because while those people could, yeah, they could like vulturize Tesla, they also could go and like create some other invention or, you know, take it a step further and also then go, well, I feel obligated to share this too because Tesla shared it. And then Tesla goes, oh, I love what you did. We can take that a step further. And they're not going step by step next to each other as competitors. They're actually branching and creating like more tech for all of us. And they're both better off. But I don't know what the research is on this. I can't tell you exactly, but I know that there's this idea that like, I think it was Spiral Dynamics that says that we cyclically go through focus on self, focus on community. And these cycles are in like 50 or 75 year cycles or whatever. And so I think it's interesting to watch that unfold because now it's like, how can you keep anything truly to yourself, you know, with the internet, what it is. So.
And this requires, you know, a great degree of agility on one's end. So transitioning towards that, you're also a certified Agile coach. So would you please share with our listeners what is an Agile coach and what would an Agile coach do or deliver for its clients or the coaching?
In some ways, it's some of the things we've already been talking about. The Agile movement started about 20 years ago in software development. And the general idea around agility is building your organization or your team or your work in a way that you can listen closely to what's going on around you through feedback loops and like intentional, seeking of information and being able to move quickly. So for software, this meant no longer building out like 5-year project plans and, you know, doing like all the architecture first and then all the front end, because if at any point in that time period, you got new information, right, about a new feature that your customer needed, you basically, your hands were tied in like the old way of thinking about project planning. And so instead we build software, but this also applies to other industries, in smaller increments that don't make our work like a house of cards. Right? Each little increment has value all in and of itself, and it pushes us toward like a bigger chunk of value. But if we find something out along the way, we can pivot. We can change course if we need to. So it started in software, but actually has now proven to be an effective way of working across the board. My husband was actually a high school teacher who used these principles in his classroom. There are marketers who use these principles. And so an Agile coach is someone who thoroughly understands those principles, understands the practices that sit on top of them, and can help you find your best path toward that kind of agility. There are a number of frameworks that people frequently use, like Scrum, Kanban. But at the end of the day, it's actually about understanding. There's 12 principles. I won't rattle them all off, but you can go to agilemanifesto.org. There are 12 principles that most Agile coaches base their work on. And so I have worked with teams. I have worked with leaders, all to understand, like, how do we listen to our customer? How do we build our work in such a way that we can change if we need to, and how do we create innovation, self-organization? A lot of the things we talked about earlier in this call are kind of part of creating a company that can move quickly.
So what would you do on a day-to-day basis when you're working with teams and organizations? Like what's your typical, like, you know, say 20,000 feet view of the process that you work with your customers or your clients?
So in some ways, there are like different levels, as you just said. So it could be anything from working with a CEO on maybe having an innovation week. You know, how do we make this space for innovation? How do we create a culture of innovation? How do we do this innovation week, but also not have that be the only innovation we do all year? All the way down to, here's a feature that this team is working on. Let me help this team understand what's the smallest slice of value that we can get out of this feature to experiment. Like, what's the smallest thing we could do to find out if this is actually what customers want? So it can be very in the weeds where you're kind of helping them, you know, see their way into making things smaller, or helping them understand, you know, how much work can we do in a given period of time, while still making space for time off and things like that. So it can be very in the weeds all the way to, how do we make this a better company?
Okay. I like that. That's because it's true. Like you were saying, you know, this is something where the mindset has to be adopted organization wide. So it, and everyone, depending upon which team or department or leadership management teams you're working with, they're all going to have different mandates that they may require. So what would be some good attributes to look out for when a team is deciding, you know, what kind of, who, if you're looking for an agile coach to help them with transitioning or helping them?
So the first thing that I would say is, like, first, the team themselves or the organization actually needs to understand what agility is and what it means for them. And then you need to find a coach who resonates with those definitions and have really good conversations about that, because the word agile has become so commonplace, which is a good thing, but that means that it can be very differently interpreted. So the first thing I would say is understand what it means for you, and then understand what it means for the coaches that you're interviewing, essentially. But to me, a really good agile coach understands the principles. The best coaches I know understand the principles because they were already part of their DNA. Like, this is the way that I saw the world before I ever knew what the word agile was through the lens of self-organization, excellence and craft, sustainable pace. These are all of the 12 principles. Experience is important, but it is not, you're going to be hard pressed to find someone who can honestly say that they've been an agile coach, quote unquote, for 20 years, because the movement has only been around for 20 years. I would be more interested in the quality of their experience. So I'd be interested in, what type of companies have you worked with? What kind of change happened there? And did the change stick? And if the change didn't stick, because sometimes that's out of the, it always is out of the coach's control. If the change didn't stick, what did you learn from it? You know, and like, what did you take away? Because I can tell you some of my, you know, biggest, I guess I would say, client failures. And yeah, like, the change didn't stick, but oh my goodness, here's what I took away from that situation, you know, and what I know now. So that's what I would say are the biggest things. It's a pretty specialized craft. And so, you know, just understanding their commitment to the craft is probably really important.
And then I like how you said, you know, also that these changes, rather than having a very long time horizon, you want them to be adopted faster, because it allows you to trial and error and learn from it, which is, it effectively de-risks your company in the long run, because you're not spending a lot of time committing yourself now where everyone's bought into it. They have such a strong fear of letting go of something. They've invested so much time and resources into it that pivots become difficult. And like you said, you know what, like, the word failure is something where our society has almost bashed, where really it's not failure. All it is just an outcome that was not expected or not favorable. And it's like, okay, you know what? What's amazing is that you get feedback. That is really the most amazing part of it, is that you did a series of actions. It resulted in an output. The output was not expected or ideal as per your expectation. And then you go back and then you scrutinize that, you analyze your chain of events, and take some learning away from it. And then for companies that are like, just, you know, obviously we've gone over a great degree of information on what a good company should, what values a good company should adhere to, because the biggest takeaway I'm getting so far from our conversation is these are really good value-based principles that one needs to implement so that the team and the organization can shine in whatever it is that they're trying to excel at. So for companies that are a little bit more hesitant, or on the fence, or, you know, just their business models maybe slightly more archaic, allowing them the short run flexibility to not be as adaptive, because that again in itself is a benefit as well for some companies. Any sort of ways where one can start making little steps towards this? Because you're going to see this new generation, or, you know, like as you said, some of the millennials who are transitioning into more seniority roles, they bring with them experiences and cultures that they want to implement. So they're very willing and understand the value of this and working together as a collective. But what's some good ways for people who, where this is so novel, so as to not scare them, what's a good way to transition into this and like with little steps or something that is manageable?
So I have two answers for that. One, the model that I referred to earlier, you know, I build it intentionally from the ground up, meaning clarity should be one of the easier things that we could do first, you know, and that's not super simple. I mean, that means like going into talking to your teams and saying, what do you have clarity about? What don't you have clarity about? You know, what can I create more clarity about between you, on your team, in the whole org, et cetera. So, you know, and then moving into context, I think not quite as easy as clarity, because there's often restraints on what you can share, but, you know, what can I create more context about? And so if you look at the model, as it goes up, it becomes harder, but the bottom line thing shouldn't be as difficult to start with. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, when I talk with teams, but I think it also applies to orgs, what is the smallest thing that you can do, given your context, given the problems that you were trying to solve? What is the smallest thing you can try? And generally, if we can try something and like see the output of that or the outcome of that, then if it's good, we add to it. If it's not good, we try something else. One of my favorite quotes is from Frozen 2. I have kids. You know what? Whatever. I would have watched it even if I didn't have kids. It's from Frozen 2. And she says, just do the next right thing. And I think when we look at transformations this large, whether they're agile or just cultural, it becomes super overwhelming. And when we can just break it down to, you know, it's the same thing as saying one step in front of the other. What is the next right thing I can do to create the best place for my organization, for us to shine?
That's very well said. Thank you. You know what? That's that truly is like, if everyone used that sort of principle, just do the next right thing, then we would constantly be on a trajectory towards improvement, where setbacks happen, but you use that as, okay, we learn, what's the next best thing? Melissa, thank you so much for your time today. You know, we've greatly appreciated your insights on how to really start making the change, you know, how to improve the company culture, how to just overall improve the entire work-life balance. You know, I mean, and like you said, because we're not separate, like you can't look at it as a balance. It is just a part of you. So it's really nice to have, thank you for committing your time and sharing such wonderful insights with all of our listeners today.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking such fun questions.
That was great. Thank you. And to all our listeners, if you would like to get in touch with Melissa, you can visit her website at melissaboggs.com. That's MelissaBoggs.com. Or you can visit our website at subjectmatterpros.com. And on the episode page, you will find links to her LinkedIn profile, her website, and additional information. Thanks once again. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode. We hope that you found it valuable. If there are any topics that you would like to recommend for future podcasts, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, please drop us a line at subjectmatterpros.com@gmail.com or by visiting our site at subjectmatterpros.com. Until the next episode.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Wild Hearts at Work. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. For more resources and to connect with Melissa, visit melissaboggs.com. Also, if you or someone you know is doing great work in a wild way, get in touch about being a guest on the show. Until next time.